This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Gordon, has written novels, memoirs, short stories, essays, and a book reflecting on Joan of Arc. Before I tell you about Gordon's new novel, I want to read you what James Carroll said in a review of Gordon's book, Joan of Arc. This quintessentially American writer, with her skeptical eye, her impatience with sentimentality, and her readiness to skewer pieties of all kinds, has also, in her fiction, proved to be motivated by a profound spiritual curiosity. She is a critic of institutional religion, whose writing is deeply rooted in Roman Catholic sacramentality. I think Gordon's new novel, Pearl, fits that description. The story begins on Christmas night, 1998, as Maria, a single mother, gets a call from the State Department saying that her daughter Pearl, who has been studying in Ireland, has chained herself to the flagpole in front of the American Embassy in Dublin. Pearl hasn't eaten in 6 weeks and is refusing food and drink. In exploring what led Pearl to put her life on the line, the novel reflects on politics, guilt, sacrifice, mother-daughter relationships, and, along the way, asks where the line is between martyrdom and suicide. Mary Gordon says that when she was growing up, martyrdom was like a job description. You could be a nurse, a teacher, or a martyr. I asked Gordon what martyrdom meant to her as a child and if she tried to emulate the martyrs.
Well, first of all, what it meant was you would go straight to heaven. And that was always the phrase, straight to heaven, like was the express train. And I remember before we were being prepared for our first communions, which is we would be 6 or 7, we were told that we should pray for a martyr's death. So you would have these 7-year-olds saying, oh, my God, I better pray that and it was the communists at that point, because it was the 50s, I better pray that a communist will say either say there is no God or we'll shoot you. But you didn't want to be shot. You basically wanted to live to have lunch. But I would do things like when I was about 9 or 10, I would put thorns in my shoes to try to walk around to experience the preliminaries of martyrdom so I'd be kind of toughened up for the real thing. But I didn't want my feet to hurt, so I would put the thorns in my shoes, then I try not to step on them. So it was a sort of a equivocal appetite for martyrdom, and nonetheless always feeling that I wasn't quite up to scratch because I wanted to live, because I didn't want to die.
What adults in your life knew that you were walking around with thorns in your shoes?
Nobody. They would, you know, really, even in my family, that would have been considered extreme. It was a real secret that I had to keep, and I knew it was strange, but part of the cult of martyrdom was that nobody understands you. You know, martyrs are never understood by their family. Their families are always telling them to shape up. And so it was part of the glamour of martyrdom that you would be misunderstood by the ordinary bourgeois world.
Being misunderstood was a classic part of American popular culture then, too. James Dean
That's
was
right.
Misunderstood. All of teenage culture was misunderstood.
Exactly. We wouldn't have known what to do with ourselves if we'd been understood. And so the roots of that are very deep and wide.
Did you ever tell any nuns about this?
Oh, no. I would never tell anybody. Mm-hmm. Because it was almost like it was too special for anybody. And I also didn't want anybody to tell me to stop. And I knew they would.
Now, in your novel, the mother was brought up Catholic, as you were. And she intentionally doesn't expose her daughter to the literature of martyrdom. What is her fear of exposing her daughter to it?
Well, her fear is fanaticism, and her fear is that a desire for purity, and the theme of a desire for purity is very important to me in this book, because I think it's a desire that doesn't get named in our culture, and so it enacts itself in very strange ways. And it is essentially a desire that the world be less mixed than it is. And Maria, who is the mother, believes that all this talk about the cult of martyrs and the cult of purity is really a love for death. And she wants her child to love life rather than death. And another aspect of modern culture that I wanted to explore in this book is what happens to all these ideals, which are larger than life and even life-denying, if they are in fact denied. It seems to me that they come out in different ways. I think that the girlhood impulse to idealism and to purity now has really relegated itself to anorexia. And I think there is something particularly in young people that desires purity, and it only now gets expressed in terms that it seems to me are really perverse, because they go back to the individual body. They don't really stand for anything larger. They're not an idea. They're only another emendation of the body.
Do you see anorexia as a quest for purity or just thinness?
I think that it's a quest for purity in the guise of thinness. That is to say, girls who are eating a carrot stick for lunch because they want to get into a bikini are one thing, but anorexia, I think, is a real desire to be purged of fleshliness. And that desire to be purged of fleshliness, I think, is a desire to be of a purity that our species simply isn't made for. But it's a very strong and, I think, quite mysterious impulse.
Did you expose your children to the literature of martyrdom?
No, absolutely not. And I have to say they have no interest in it. One of the my children are less romantic than I am, with a capital R. They wouldn't dream of doing the things that that I did when I was a child, and they're much more practical. They actually do more good in the world, more effective good than I did with all my dreams of heroic goodness. And so that's very interesting to me to see what they do. But they're not extremists. They're not attracted to the extremes that I was when I was younger.
What were the other extremes you were attracted to?
Well, I think, when I'm coming of age in the 60s, I really believed that, and because I thought I was an artist, I thought that you had to experience everything. And you couldn't say no to anything. You couldn't be afraid of drugs, sex, or rock and roll. Or political extremism, that in order to be fully alive, you had to be very risk-taking and push things to their extremes. And I don't think that my kids have that impulse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Mary Gordon. Her new novel is called Pearl. So in your novel, Pearl not only decides to become a martyr for the cause of the IRA, but also for something more personal, she develops a kind of self-hatred of her body. Her mother thinks that the things she did would spare her daughter from feeling that way. And just as I think a lot of mothers felt that bringing up their children in a feminist context would spare them the kind of pre-feminist self-consciousness and self-hatred that so many girls felt. And in a lot of instances, it just didn't work. It wasn't enough. It wasn't, there seems to be something deeper.
Yeah, and this was something that I really wanted to explore about motherhood, that when you have babies or young children, you think, well, I'll do it this way and the world won't touch them. And often that doesn't work out. And I think particularly in the case of feminism, one of the things that feminism hasn't touched at all, and I'm a feminist, I'm not afraid to use the F word at all, but one of the things that the women's movement hasn't touched because the culture has been too strong is this notion of the hatefulness of the female body. Women are more obsessed with weight than ever. There are more products on the market that tell us that we're wrong, there's something wrong with us. The boom in plastic surgery, which seems to me just bizarre, has come in the wake of the women's movement. So obviously we have done nothing to say that the female body is not in itself inherently hateful. And if you have a girl child, you say, oh, I'll put her in Oshkosh overalls when she's little, and, I'll cut her hair short and she can play soccer with the boys, and I'll never make her wear high heels and never tell her she has to wear a girdle and she'll love herself. It didn't work so well in face of this pervasive cultural message that there is something inherently loathsome about the female body. And that makes me very sad.
Have your views on why so many girls and women as well have this discomfort about or hatred of their own bodies. Have your views changed on that from, say, the 60s or the 70s?
No. The only thing that I think that it's in the interest of whatever dark forces they are, and I don't know who they are. It's too simple to say capitalism. It's too simple to say men. I don't exactly know what it is. All I know is that every woman I know spends too much time thinking about the way that she looks. And if she doesn't spend time thinking about the way she looks, then that can be a kind of self-hatred, because at its best, adornment, I mean, I have to tell you, I'm a person with 200 pairs of shoes, so it's not like I want to, you know, make myself out to be Emma Goldman. At its best, adornment is play and joy. At its worst, it's anxiety and self-loathing. And what makes me sad is that for women, either adornment or a lack of adornment more often is a source of anxiety and self-loathing than of joy and play and freedom.
Do you feel like you have a good fix on whether self-adornment is joy and freedom in your life or an expression of self-loathing or somewhere in between?
Well, you know, I'm not a perfect person, so it kind of depends. I know that shoes are a perfect place of pleasure for me because I have no anxiety about my feet. So
in spite of the thorns that you used to wear there.
Well, maybe that's why. My feet have been purified by a martyr's blood, so I deserve all those shoes. So I can say that the parts of my body that I feel secure about, namely my feet, I can really play with. And then there are other things that, depending upon how I look that day or where the 10 pounds is one way or another, can be either fun or self-punishment. So it's a very, I think, vexing and difficult problem. But look, it's only very recently in the history of the planet that we assumed that women were similar to men in most ways and might be equal to most men. My particular theory is that's why the world is having a nervous breakdown, because of the relatively new news that men and women might be equal. It's making everybody crazy, because it's a lot to absorb as a species, and we've had to absorb it very fast.
Give me an example of why you think that's the cause of the nervous breakdown.
Because I think that what all fundamentalisms share is a desire to repress women. That I was in Israel one time, and I went to the Wailing Wall, and the men had to pray separately from the women. I went to the Dome of the Rock. The men had to pray separately from the women. I went to the Tomb of the Holy Sepulchre, and the women weren't allowed in the sanctuary. And I thought, the way to get all these people to stop fighting with each other is to have women step in the sacred places, and they would all join together as brothers and tear the women limb from limb. Because it seems to me that that is the thing that unites all fundamentalisms. What I don't exactly understand is the women who join with them in this desire to exclude themselves. That's a real puzzler for me, except I think that there's a lot of fear in the world, and I almost feel very sorry for the poor species. It seems that we're just rocked by fear and fear of the unknown, and I think one of the unknowns is how to live together as partners who might be not identical, but at least equal.
Every time we talk on Fresh Air, I like to ask where you are in terms of your own spiritual life, whether you're going to church, because throughout your life, or throughout your adult life, there's been this kind of tug of war between your kind of spiritual commitment to an interest in Catholicism and your disagreements with the organized religion part of it, the hierarchy, the church's views on birth control and divorce and abortion and women in general. So where are you now?
I'm in despair. I think the church has never been at a lower point in my lifetime. The church's sexual phobia is just worse than ever. The pedophilia scandal, instead of being a moment of self-examination and humility, has been an excuse for the church to be more fortress-like, more homophobic than ever. I don't see many new progressive forces in the church. I still do go to church. I was just reading Cecil Meemaw's last volume of poetry, which he wrote in his 90s, in which he keeps saying, I have no justification for doing this, but I believe in these practices as being somehow leading to something valuable. And what I do is I pick and choose. There are a couple of places in the world where I can be Catholic, and most where I can only be in a rage. Nevertheless, I hold on to the ideal of people like Oscar Romero, Pope John the 23rd, Dorothy Day, Thomas Merton. Again, it is that ideal of self-giving and a world larger than the individual bourgeois biography that I'm very drawn to and that I don't seem, despite my rage and despair, able to quite give up.
What are the couple of places that you feel most at home being Catholic in?
Well, I have a church that's in my neighborhood, which actually was the church that Thomas Merton was baptized in. And there are some wonderful people there that I can really be with. And a few priests, and particularly nuns. I did a long piece a couple of years ago for the Atlantic Monthly on the state of American nuns, or actually nuns worldwide. They're really radical. They really are self-giving. They really are large of heart. And I have met in these people an expansiveness of spirit that moves me very, very deeply. So it's the people that I see in these places that live in a way that is more suggestive of a radical and deep openness, which is what I think we're on the earth for.
You know, I remember what I think was our first interview in the 1980s. And you were in Philadelphia doing, I guess, a signing and some interviews. And you had left your two children behind for the day in, I guess, New York. And I remember you saying that you not only missed your children, you physically missed having your baby in your arms. And I think now, you know, of you being the mother of two adult children. and what a different experience of motherhood that is.
Oh, yeah. I could have had a million babies. You know, I mean, just babies and little children. That was easy for me because they had no moral life. But when I had to come to terms with the fact that they were independent, moral and intellectual beings that wouldn't necessarily do what I wanted, that was when I found motherhood more difficult. The animal parts of motherhood I could do with, you know, my hands tied behind my back. I could change diapers and clean up vomit and spill juice and make Play-Doh all day long. But when somebody said, you know, I'm not going to do what you want me to do because I don't want to do it, that was the more difficult part. And then to watch them, and I'm really lucky. I have wonderful children who, my daughter particularly, has, you know, stood up to me and bucked me. And I think that one of her first sentences was, I'm not you. And she's not me. She's actually a lot better than I am. But watching them say to me over and over again in words and in language, I'm not you, has been a very great moral challenge for me. And I miss, you know, I miss them terribly. My daughter's in California. My son's in Michigan. And you know, ideally, I'd like to be one of those Italian mothers that has a three-story house with the children, you know, and their families and children on the upper levels. I think that would be my idea of a good time. I very much miss the presence of these animal children in my life. I miss the smell of them. I miss cooking for them. And I do think the best part of my life is over because they live so far away. And I adored having young children. And it's one of the losses, it seems to me, that aging brings. And they're terrific and they have their own lives, but it's not as much fun.
Why do you call it a moral challenge? Like when your children started saying to you, I'm not you. Why a moral challenge and not just a kind of crisis of self-confidence and ego?
Because I think you have to judge whether they're saying they're not you and whether their decisions are ethical and right in their own terms, which might be different from your terms. So you really have to start thinking, are there other ways of being in the world besides mine that are still acceptable? And that's a real challenge because you'd like everybody to be, or I want everybody to be exactly like me. My idea of a good time is if everybody says to me, you're absolutely right, 24 hours a day. And my husband once said to me, on your tombstone, it's not going to be only the words, I was right. It's going to be, I was right and you were wrong. So for my children to not have been clones of me was a challenge for me to look at them not as myself, but as people really, really other from me. And to say that within those boundaries, how do I then guide them to a way of life that was good and luminous and fruitful for themselves and for the world, even if it wasn't exactly my way. I did think that was a great moral challenge and a challenge of imagination.
You said something very funny in a piece that you wrote, something very funny about your son. You wrote, and again, he's an adult now, you wrote, he's the kind of boy who wouldn't have gone out with me in high school.
Exactly. You know, He's very, very handsome, and he's, he's really hot, and I would have been absolutely outside the sphere. I mean, he's very kind, so he might have danced with me occasionally, but I couldn't have measured up to his girlfriends at all. He's a cool guy, and I didn't go out with any cool guys in high school.
That's really funny.
I mean, my son would not have been in the my son was on the basketball team. I went out with boys that were in chess club, if I went out at all. It just wouldn't have happened. And it was always a surprise to me. I kept saying, where does this person come from? Where does this person come from? And I was very interesting as a woman and as a feminist to have to see that I had this kind of eminently beautiful, eminently desirable male. And how is his mother... did I give him permission to be that in the world, which is a gift and a wonderful thing, but say to him, you know, a lot of guys use the gifts that you've been given in really terrible ways, and that's not okay. And that was a very interesting balance to have to try to keep.
Do you know what your next book will be?
I have a couple of projects. I'm working now on a book about my mother, who died 2 years ago. And she.
I meant to ask you about her because you had a beautiful piece about her, a magazine piece about her having Alzheimer's,
yeah.
In which you raised all kinds of interesting questions, like if you go there to visit her at the home where she was, and if she enjoyed the experience but then immediately forgot it,
yeah.
Was there still a point in you going if it was not something that was going to be remembered beyond a minute? So it was a wonderful piece.
Yeah, and she was really in a state of, I don't know whether it was Alzheimer's or dementia, for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to write a book that I'm calling Circling My Mother, which is to try to recover from before those 11 years a mother that was not quite so damaged, and to get back to trying to know my mother despite the stain of those extremely painful years. So I'm doing that. I have another novel in my head. I have a series of novellas that I'm working on, and I'm not quite sure which project will come first.
Is it hard to find the memories of your mother from the period before she was sick? I mean, has being sick overshadowed all the other memories?
It has, and so I feel that it's a very important work to know her fully, because she had a long life. She was 95. And to recover that life, to recover the mother who was delightful to me, even when she was problematic, she was also a source of great delight. So it is a labor, but I think it's an important one to sort of dig out from the rubble of her last illness a delightful mother.
And where are you going to find about who she was?
Well, one of the pieces that I'm working on now is about my mother and her perfume. That I discovered a perfume that my mother had used, which kind of went off the market for a long time, which was Arpège. And I was in the airport in Paris, and I said, oh my God, Arpège, I'll smell it. And I smelt it, and a whole world opened up to me. So I'm interested in exploring her through her scents, and through the perfumes that she used, which were a way of my being delighted by her and being delighted by the possibility of being female.
In trying to reconstruct your mother's life, are you starting to think about things that you have experienced as a mother? So you think of your mother from the perspective of a daughter, but you're a mother of two grown children yourself now, and you've just written a book, written a novel about a mother-daughter relationship. So are you trying to understand things from your mother's point of view that you never perhaps noticed before? And I'm wondering if any of the issues, any of the mother-daughter issues that you bring up in your novel Pearl, if you think any of those existed for your mother.
I think my mother was so radically different from me in that, when I say this, it sounds snobbish or elitist, and I hope to be able to get past that. My mother was a peasant. My mother, she was very, very smart, but she absolutely did not believe in self-consciousness. She thought she was in the grips of fate. She would have called it God's will. But she didn't think she had a lot of control over her life, or she was not particularly interested in shaping it. And she was absolutely uninterested in self-examination or self-analysis. You know, and she would say to me, well, you know, you dwell on things. You just harp on things, and you just make yourself miserable. I just live. And the fact that my mother was essentially an unself-conscious person makes her so different from me. I mean, my mother would just had virtually no self-censorship mechanism. She would just say anything that came into her head with no notion that that might leave a mark on me. And I was so conscious of everything that I said potentially leaving a mark that it was almost as if we had very different experiences as mothers. And my mother was also physically handicapped. She was a polio victim. And so I was her caretaker in a way that I was determined that my children were not going to be my caretakers. I mean, I was just going to run marathons to prove that they didn't need to take care of me. And when I see some of the rages and anxieties in myself that my mother had, I always say, oh, God, I really don't want to be that. I think we share a playfulness and a love of pleasure. But essentially, because she was an unself-conscious person who thought she had really very little control over her life, we're such different people that I don't think our experiences were very similar.
Mary Gordon, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too, Terry. Thank you.
Mary Gordon's new novel is called Pearl.